whatever the relationship may look like going forward, this is a signal.
North Korea may be ready to resume talks. It's February 21st. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us now online if you're able to by logging on to VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, U.S. policy in Korea remains firm. Concerns about terror fighters returning home. A personal perspective of Japanese internment camps 75 years ago. And the travel ban and tourism. Travel with us right now on VOA Asia. The Washington Post reports that preparations are underway to bring senior North Korean representatives to the United States for talks with former U.S. officials. That would be the first such meeting in 5 years. But arrangements have been complicated by Pyongyang's recent ballistic missile test and the mysterious circumstances surrounding the death of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, last week in Malaysia. Asan Institute for Policy Studies research fellow Go Myung-hyun in Seoul tells VOA's Victor Beatty, while the North wants to be recognized as a nuclear state, he does not view this as a potential breakthrough, but an exploratory effort.
I think North Korea intends to find out more about the Trump administration's ultimate intentions about North Korea.
Has North Korea's position changed on anything substantive?
Nothing at all. Well, one thing that the North Koreans are very good at is consistency. Their objective is clearly to be recognized as a nuclear state by the United States. And I don't think North Korea is willing to entertain the idea of denuclearization through these talks.
There are already established communication links, back-channel links, if you will, in New York at the UN. If they were really interested in substantive talks, they would pursue those back-channels?
North Korea and the United States have been pursuing track to dialogue since, several times since last year at least. And these back-channels are usually in order to find out each other's intentions. North Korean government would like to send their people to the United States and hold talks in the United States. That way, they'll be able to discuss this matter, not just with their direct interlocutors who are inviting them to the United States, but they will have the chance of talking to actual U.S. officials. And that way, North Korea will be sure about the United States' future strategy about North Korea.
Go Myung-hyun said while the expectations of any breakthrough in such talks is low, a direct dialogue would reduce the risk of miscalculation or confrontation. Meanwhile, China has announced it is suspending all imports of North Korean coal, part of its effort to enforce UN sanctions against Pyongyang. Korea Economic Institute analyst Troy Stangerone was asked how effective this move might be.
We won't really know how this is all going to play out until we get trade data for both January and February. Most likely towards the end of March. Right now, North Korea was exporting to China. Well, last month they did over 215 million in exports. And for 2017, there was a cap through the UN sanctions of 400 million. So in essence, China may already, depending on how exports were flowing, be close to hitting that cap. And so this could simply be them enforcing UN sanctions.
So you don't see this as a real pinch on North Korea?
I think by this point, we've probably already seen perhaps not all the exports North Korea have been able to do under UN sanctions, but a significant portion. So while it is a pinch, I don't think it's going to be significantly greater than what we were expecting under the sanctions.
Now, this, of course, comes in the wake of North Korea's most recent rocket launch. That followed a conciliatory phone call between President Trump and his counterpart in China, Xi Jinping. According to one analyst, that may indicate it was part of a North Korean attempt to sow division between China and the U.S., and that pressed Beijing to bring more pressure on Pyongyang.
I do think that this is a good sign. We had a situation to where prior to the phone call between President Trump and Xi Jinping, there had been significant tension in U.S.-China relations and concern that Beijing may not enforce sanctions. I think at this point, what we can say is that whatever the relationship may look like going forward, this is a signal that the Chinese are not necessarily going to let that flow into the situation with North Korea, at least not at this point.
Troy Stangerone says Pyongyang may have already received the revenue it needed from coal. He said if China really wanted to punish North Korea, it could cut off its primary source of oil. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. North Korea and Malaysia at odds over death of Kim Jong-un's brother. Pakistan and Afghanistan move to defuse border tensions. UN presses ASEAN to boost cooperation as Islamic State builds regional links. Vietnam seeks stronger China ties despite new buildup on disputed islands. Rohingya activist says 1,000 refugees returned to Myanmar. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis has reassured South Korea that U.S. commitment to defend it remains intact. VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Patton joins us to explain more about some of the issues involved.
President Trump has kind of really touched on a longstanding concern in Asia, and particularly in South Korea, about whether the U.S. is really sincere in its commitments to protect South Korea from a nuclear attack if that were to occur from North Korea. He introduced during the campaign some doubt about whether the U.S. would protect its allies as it has promised for the last 50 or 60 years. And Trump had said if allies like South Korea did not pay more for defense sharing costs, he might consider pulling out U.S. troops, not defending them if they were attacked, and allowing their U.S. allies to acquire their own nuclear weapons. This touched a nerve with a lot of conservative hawks in South Korea who have long been advocating for South Korea to acquire their own nuclear weapons. Their arguments are getting more mainstream attention.
The importance of the nuclear issue on the Korean Peninsula was underscored by U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. That was his first trip overseas, so it really made a statement that the United States takes this very seriously.
Yeah, General Mattis, when he came with a very reassuring message that the U.S. will maintain its longstanding security commitments in the region. He walked back most of President Trump's disruptive comments. And to be fair, President Trump himself, since he was elected, has also reassured allies in the region that they would maintain the close alliances that have been in place. But Mattis in particular had said that, you know, the U.S. would respond with overwhelming force to any attack from North Korea, that they would continue to defend their allies and continue to uphold mutual defense treaties. He was very explicit in these remarks. The mainstream argument for keeping this close alliance with the U.S. and maintaining the U.S. nuclear umbrella is that if that would fall apart, the entire strategy for pressuring North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons would fall apart as well.
General Mattis did reassure South Korea that the United States was committed to deploying the THAAD missile defense shield, which has stirred some controversy in South Korea, especially with the political shakeup going on right now.
Exactly. While the U.S. is very strongly in support of this anti-missile shield, it is seen by China and North Korea and Russia as escalating the U.S. military presence here, of putting in new weaponry that could be used not only to defend against the North Korean attack, but that could also be targeted against China, specifically to monitor any sort of missile or weaponry in that region. So a lot of South Koreans are wondering if it's worth the price of having this missile defense system here that would rattle China, and they wonder about how much defense it would actually provide in the case of a major North Korean attack, in the sense that the THAAD missile system is limited to these high-altitude missiles coming in. That's what it's designed to protect against. Well, cities like Seoul are so close to North Korea that they are vulnerable to low-altitude attacks. They could be barraged with missiles that could not be countered by the THAAD systems. And while you have the South Korean government firmly in the U.S. camp on this, the South Korean government is going through a major transition right now. President Park Geun-hye has been impeached. Opposition leaders want to hold off on THAAD until a new election takes place. So that could be a barometer of where relations with the U.S. will be going in the next year. You could see some arguments between the U.S. and South Korea evolving that are not there at the present time.
Our VOA correspondent in Seoul, Brian Patton. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Happening now in Asia, North Korea's envoy to Malaysia says Kuala Lumpur's investigation into the death of Kim Jong-un's half-brother is politically motivated. Malaysia calls the allegations baseless and has four suspects in custody. Four North Koreans believed to have fled Malaysia on the day of the attack against Kim Jong-nam are also being sought. Stay up to date with VOA. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. The United Nations says Southeast Asia needs to put in place a comprehensive regional plan to combat a rising threat of violent extremism as Asian fighters return home from Iraq and Syria. Jeremy Douglas, the UN's Office of Drugs and Crime Asia Regional Representative, said current measures are inconsistent among Southeast Asian countries.
And the region itself doesn't have a strategy to deal with that. There's some strategies at national level to an extent, but they're very inconsistent across the region. And then the region itself does not have a strategy to deal with this phenomenon.
He said it was important for ASEAN to develop a regional prevention of violent extremism plan that is subsequently tailored for each country. Human rights lawyer and author Benjamin Zawaki agrees that cross-regional cooperation may be a challenge.
It's going to be difficult for Southeast Asian countries to come up with sort of a collective policy, you know, to which all 10 countries within ASEAN are going to agree, because ISIS is one of these things that is so new. I mean, everyone still sees the region, as does the U.S. in many ways, sees the region and sees the various insurgencies in the region as independent entities, you know, into which they hope ISIS doesn't make any inroads. But there's no real incentive at the moment for sort of combating or preempting ISIS in the region, where so far at least its evidence is really minimal.
Our thanks to correspondent Ron Corbin in Bangkok for following this story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A possible pirate attack in the southern Philippines killed one member of a Vietnamese ship. Seven were abducted. The Philippine Coast Guard was able to rescue the other 17 Vietnamese crew members. The Abu Sayyaf militant group is thought to be responsible for the attack. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia continues as 75 years ago, people of Japanese heritage in the United States were forced from their homes without due process and locked up for years following Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor during World War II. Washington was concerned that Japanese immigrants and Japanese Americans might plot against the United States. As survivors commemorate the 75th anniversary of the executive order that authorized their incarceration, many are speaking out to make sure that what happened to them doesn't happen to Muslims, Latinos, or other groups in light of recent executive orders from President Donald Trump. A few years ago, I spoke with Hank Umamoto, who was sent to Manzanar internment camp in California. He shared his experience with us.
Well, before it wasn't bad. I was born and raised in Florian, that's a suburb, I mean, not suburb, but rural area near Sacramento. And we were grape and strawberry farmers. And there we were predominantly Japanese. So there was no, we didn't feel any discrimination or anything of that sort. We had white neighbors. So we got along very well. Then came Pearl Harbor, and we had to leave.
How were people in your community sent to the internment camps?
They divided the West Coast, the evacuation area, the Washington, Oregon, and California, into 108 areas, and they called it exclusion areas. And first one to evacuate were the Bainbridge people. There were about 350 of them, and they were sent to Manzanar internment camp. And by the time it came to our turn, ours was 92, and we evacuated. We were told to evacuate our area by midnight, May 30th, 1942. So there was this 5 or 6 month period. It took that long to evacuate everybody. During the meantime, in February, a couple months after Pearl Harbor, they started building the internment camps, 10 main relocation camps. Manzanar was one of the camps.
Do you know how many Japanese Americans were sent to these camps, and did they have any other choices?
We had a choice of leaving the area. 5,000 people voluntarily left the West Coast, but the rest of us, 113,000, we didn't have anywhere to go, so we were sent to camps. There were eight towers, searchlights, machine guns, and barbed wire fence, armed soldiers patrolling the area. Yeah, at first, it was sort of like a concentration camp, but then the people turned it into a community. So we had activities, in fact, and opportunities.
As Japanese Americans like yourself made the best of living in the camps, what else did you have that turned out to be good?
I was born on a farm with outhouses. At camp, there was this high technology gadget, like flushing toilet. And they had luxury items like toilet tissue. So by the time I left Manzanar, my aggression, my frustration, my anger, it had disappeared. And today you could tell that I have nothing but fond memories of Manzanar.
Hank Omomoto is the author of Manzanar to Mount Whitney. Hank, thank you so much for joining us and giving us this great eyewitness account of living in the Japanese-American internment camps.
Well, it was fun talking with you.
Omomoto is now 89 years old, and he remains involved in the restoration of Manzanar internment camp as a national historic site for future generations to learn and understand that period of time in U.S. history. More is on our website at voanews.com. Developing at this hour in Asia, Cambodia's parliament amended a law to bar anyone convicted of an offense from seeking public office. Effectively banned is Prime Minister Hun Sen's main political rival, Sam Rainsy, who stepped down this month as his party's leader. Critics say multi-party democracy is undermined. Rainsy rejects charges against him as politically motivated. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, despite a temporary halt to President Trump's executive order banning travelers from 7 countries, travel and tourism executives are beginning to notice signs of financial damage. VOA's Ramon Taylor reports.
You may have heard this before. Uncertainty is bad for business. Although President Trump's controversial travel ban was in effect for just 1 week, the global tourism industry is already beginning to notice unintended financial consequences. Travel industry analyst Henry Hartefelt explains via Skype.
People start planning their summer holidays 90 days or more in advance. They start doing the research. And if we look less attractive, and when you couple that with factors that the dollar is strong right now, it just makes the U.S. that much less attractive as a possible destination.
According to the travel data company Forward Keys, net airline bookings to the U.S. dropped 6.5% overall while the ban was in place, compared to the same period in 2016. Data compiled by the Global Business Travel Association calculates that just a 1% loss on annual U.S. business travel spending would result in a loss of $5 billion in gross domestic product, along with 71,000 jobs. President Trump, in a recent meeting with U.S. airline executives, attempted to quell some of their concerns.
We have an obsolete plane system, we have obsolete airports, we have obsolete trains, we have bad roads. We're going to change all of that, folks. So you're going to be so happy with Trump.
While rebuilding infrastructure would create some jobs, trade policy expert Dan Eikenson says the ban could affect specialized workers, in fields like technology.
The threat of this restriction spreading is something that's going to put a pall over business and over investment. I assume that companies that may have been considering setting up operations in the United States or U.S. operations that may have wanted to set up affiliates and subsidiaries abroad are suspending those plans.
The average tourist in New York's Times Square is conflicted about whether to return given the possible reinstatement of the travel ban by the courts.
I'd be more comfortable going to London as compared to New York because, you know, London doesn't have this ban, so you'd be more at ease going there.
Honestly, I don't really care about this because like a tourist, I'm feeling by myself very comfortable over here.
Part of what drives foreign tourists to New York City, apart from shopping, dining, and entertainment, is its diversity. Most here agree that this makes the city and country great. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
And now that you've had the opportunity to hear Ramon Taylor's report, go to our website at voanews.com and watch it. He has some great video to accompany it, and you'll be glad you did, along with many other videos and audio and text that we have available on our website. Don't forget our Facebook page, VOA Asia. You can find all kinds of great posts there as well. And VOA Burmese, thanks to all of our listeners in Myanmar who are listening with us today. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can follow us again on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Dave Magnus, and our managing editor is Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today is President's Day in the United States, when Americans pause to honor their national leaders, beginning with the first president, George Washington. From the time of his death in 1799, his birthday, February 22nd, was marked unofficially. It formally became a national holiday in 1885. Over time, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls near Washington's. Official recognition of the two began in 1971, with a day honoring all presidents every year on the third Monday of the month. Washington won lasting fame for leading Americans to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. His popularity was such that he could have made himself a king if he'd so chosen. Some of the officers in his army, impatient with the democratic process, urged him to do just that. "Banish these thoughts from your mind," Washington said, and issued a stern reprimand to those who made the suggestion. He ordered the army disbanded, resigned his commission as commander-in-chief, and retired to private life. At the time, America was a loose confederation of 13 states. Over the next 6 years, Americans struggled to devise an effective federal government, but one that left important powers to the states. Many Americans distrusted the idea of a central government and feared abuses of power by federal officials, especially the president. At this critical time, Washington was the one person who most Americans were willing to trust. He was the unopposed choice to be the nation's first president. When he took office, the United States had a constitution, but its government was not yet organized. When he stepped down, the U.S. was recognized by the world's major powers. Washington put the nation on a sound financial footing and created an effective military to protect America's expanding frontiers. In revolutionary France, democratic ideals gave way to turmoil, terror, and repression. But in the United States, under Washington's leadership, revolution produced stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, he set an important precedent for all future presidents. He also oversaw a peaceful transfer of power from one elected leader to another, a principle vital to democracy and an example for peoples around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.